Enter, if you dare.
Welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, you're actually in Michigan.
I am this week, yes.
Oh, very good, very good. Speak of the devil, ScareCon New York, because they have two a year, one in New England and one in New York, is actually being moved to Rochester, New York.
Yes.
Wow.
And so now I'm like really mad at you guys for making me go all the way to Massachusetts when it was in my hometown in October.
We didn't even know about it, the move, or at least I didn't even know about it until about a couple of days ago.
I knew they were moving it, I didn't know where.
Yeah.
I just assumed it would still be up somewhere near Turning Stone. I didn't think it was, you know, because it was, that's where it was. I figured they just moved to a new location in that vicinity. I didn't know they were going to Rochester, which is only about an hour from me.
It's all good.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll see if it goes well for them and if they want to do it there next year.
Right. Yep, absolutely.
And we would have to find out, you know, like if Leo and the rest are doing it this year.
That's another factor, yes.
I don't think they are. They're going to do Rock and Shock, which is in Worcester, Massachusetts. Obviously, they actually told me personally that if they never can do it and they still need people to help out, we can do it. So both Leo and Crest from ScareCon said that. So
they said Leo and Crest said what?
Why did we wait that, to start talking about this while we're recording?
That Dark Discussions would be able to do the panels and all that if necessary.
Okay.
So if we did want to do it. Okay, so sorry about all that off topic stuff,
you can edit that out.
I guess I can. And in the state of New York.
Oh, that's me. Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how are you?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. And a Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how are you?
I'm great. I just poured my first glass of wine.
That's a total lie.
Red wine.
Crossed that threshold years ago.
Okay, yeah, I did. Actually, I crossed it 2 hours ago, so I totally lied. I'm on my third. We'll see how this show goes.
white, or rose?
No, white. White.
Okay. Chardonnay or Pinot Grigio?
It is an Australian.
Australian, mate.
Sauvignon Blanc. Yep.
Oh, there you go. Very good. All right. And
Sauvignon Blanc.
And who are we? We are Dark Discussions Podcast. Basically, we discuss weekly topics such as horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno-thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, midnight movies, cult films, art house films, foreign films, and whatnot. And we try to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. Eric, where can people find us on the internet? Our webpage and such?
Our webpage is at darkdiscussions.com. You can go there, and under the audio section, you can find all our past episodes available for free, as well as all of our spinoff podcasts. Front and center, we have a link to our Patreon account, and on the right-hand side, we have links to Friends of the Pod. So check us out at darkdiscussions.com.
And what's that Patreon thing all about?
The Patreon is a service that lets you support your online artist financially by donating. You can pledge a certain amount a month. If you care to help us offset the cost of producing this podcast, you can go donate at the link on the front page or go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. For every $5 a month you care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly cover on the podcast. We take all the submissions and draw them on a quarterly basis to choose a topic from our listeners to cover on the show.
Excellent. Very good. Very good. We have some house cleaning stuff, but we can get into all that at near the end of the episode. Any things that anybody needs to bring up, though, before we decide or discuss our topic?
No, we can do it all at the end.
All right, sounds good. Speaking of our topic, Eric, tonight's topic is a Patreon, right? Which
it is. I believe this was chosen by Holly Masiak, correct?
That's right. Holly Masiak chose this one, and we randomly generated a number, and it landed on her film, which is the film we're going to talk about tonight. So, Eric, what is that we're going to talk about tonight?
Tonight we're going to be talking about the 1997 film starring, it's got a bunch of big names in it. It's got Al Pacino, it's got Keanu Reeves, it's got Charlize Theron. We're going to be talking about The Devil's Advocate.
A young attorney has the chance of a lifetime.
Milton Chadwick Waters, we want you to come to New York. All expenses, first class, travel and lodging, you and your wife.
Oh, my God.
He will enter a place of wealth and ambition.
We've got 40 partners vested at the moment. In addition to our corporate clients, we're currently representing about 25 foreign countries. He's got you scheduled for 15 minutes, so make the most of it.
John Milton.
Kevin Lomax.
Well, what's that like? One day you're putting them away, next day you're setting them free.
Takes a little getting used to.
Pays better, though, doesn't it?
Welcome to Babylon, Mark.
Speak of the devil!
A world of power and seduction.
Who's that with the senator?
Controlled by one man.
I swear he can hear us.
Hell, he can smell us.
He will make your dreams come true.
Want to come upstairs and...
No.
He will grant your fondest wish.
I'm just warming my hands on your talent. You know what I see? I see the future of this law firm.
He knows your greatest fear.
Milton is into everything. Arms brokering, chemical weapons, toxic waste, money laundering for the Eastern Bloc. I mean, it goes on and on.
I don't like it here, Kevin.
And he knows the price of your soul.
Let's make a beef.
Who are you?
Oh, I have so many names. I'm here on the ground with my nose in it since the whole thing began. God likes to watch. He's an absentee landlord.
Keanu Reeves.
He's always been there. I know that now.
Al Pacino.
As God sleeps late.
We will win.
It's my time now.
The Devil's Advocate.
It also has Connie Nielsen in it and a few other television actors.
Craig T. Nelson?
Yep. Yeah, that's right. Yep, he's in there too. Yep. Jeffrey Jones. That's exactly right. He is in there. That's right. This is a film from 22 years ago, which is quite shocking. It was before Charlize Theron and Connie Nielsen actually were A-listers. These were this was kind of one of their first films that made them semi-popular. Obviously Keanu Reeves was somewhat of a hot commodity at the time, and now he's had a huge rejuvenation in the past 3 years or so. Al Pacino, this is part of his rebirth from his dead period from 78 to 88 or something like that. The film was directed by a guy named Taylor Hackford. Oddly, I don't know too much about him, though he did direct some fairly decent films in the past, including Dolores Claiborne, among others. The film was written by Jonathan Lemkin, who, again, I'm not too familiar with him, but he has done a number of films, including working on The Red Planet, Lethal Weapon 4, and a bunch of television, including Beverly Hills 90210, Hill Street Blues, and 21 Jump Street. Tony Gilroy, who co-wrote the script. And for folks who don't know who he is an Academy Award director for Michael Clayton and the brother of I forget the guy's name, but Gilroy, Dan Gilroy, maybe, that did Nightcrawler. And he was a huge writer of many films in the past and directed many films as well. He's one of the better talents in Hollywood. And he's also pretty good friends with Hack Ford, the guy that directed this film, because he wrote the screenplay, for example, Dolores Claiborne, as well as this film. So they obviously know each other quite well. So that's all I got. The film's budget was $57 million, made $153 million at the box office. I guess we can go around and discuss how we heard about this film and what we felt about it, though, again, 22 years ago, many of us may have seen it a long time ago. So, Eric, why don't you start?
Okay, I don't exactly remember how I first heard about this film, but given the time it came out, I'm actually going to guess that I was in my Al Pacino phase at that point. In the 90s, there was a period of time when I was catching up on all Al Pacino's movies because I had not seen them. So I think this was about that time. So this caught my attention because he was in it. And of course, it looked like a cool horror movie. So I went to see it and I was pleasantly surprised. I like this movie. It's a personal favorite. I have it on DVD. I will say upon rewatching it recently to do this, the quality on the DVD doesn't quite hold up. I admit I'm a bit of an AV snob at this point. The DVD does not scale well to 4K. I'll say that. There's a lot of grain on it. But that's neither here nor there. The movie's still fun. 90s CG is a little rough, but other than that, it's a pretty good movie. I like it.
Right. Yeah. And for folks who don't know, there is no Blu-ray edition of this film yet. So that's probably the reason why no one's been able to see it in true HD format yet. Chrissy.
This movie came out about a year after I had moved into Charles's house. And Charles, who is my housemate, really opened my eyes to a lot of really interesting films and horror films and genre films and sci-fi and all of these movies that I had never had the opportunity to be exposed to. And I remember we went to see this when it was in the theater simply because I loved Keanu Reeves, because I fell in love with Keanu Reeves in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure because I was that young at the time. I think I was 21 when that movie came out. I just wanted to see him. And this is where I kind of picked up on the fact that Keanu Reeves might actually have acting chops and not just being silly. I really like this film, but I did not watch it again until we had to watch it for this podcast. So it has probably been, I don't know, 20-something years since I'd seen it. And coming at it with more adult eyes was a very interesting experience. So.
All right. Very good. Yeah, for me... I followed actors a lot when I was younger. At that time, Jane Fonda was my favorite actress, and my favorite actors at the time were two. There was Robert Duvall, and probably still is my favorite actor of all time, and Al Pacino. So anything that they happened to be in, including Jane Fonda, the three of them, were films that I would want to check out. So this one came out and it got really good reviews. And as Eric said, it was a horror film. So this really kind of interested me for sure. So I was there on opening day at my local theater and watched it. I liked it a whole lot. It had a lot of drama elements to it. I felt more than the horror element, which is kind of interesting because even though there's a lot of horror elements in the film, it wasn't necessarily that scary. But it's a well-made film, excellently directed, obviously excellently written because Gilroy was one of the co-screenwriters. and the acting was pretty solid. And of course, we get to see Connie Nielsen and Charlize Theron in their birthday suits, which is not a bad thing either. So all in all, this film was a really good film. I've watched it maybe 6 times. But saw it once at the theaters and got the disc, the same disc that Eric has, and watched it 2 to 4 times in the last 22 years. And then, again, recently, and then obviously for this podcast. So, yeah, it's a really solid film. If folks haven't seen it, they should really get to see it and go out to see it, because it has a interesting take on a genre that can repeat itself over and over. Even though it is a Faustian tale, it is in the modern day, and it does it really well. Mike?
Yeah, so this, you know, was in theaters, and I was watching, you know, even then, going to a lot of theaters. I remember seeing the local discount theater when it came out, so it probably had been out for a little bit. I'm still having trouble getting past Eric Webster having an Al Pacino face, because I just keep picturing him walking around going, hoo-ha, hoo-ha. But, yeah, it was, you know, Pacino was in it. Keanu Reeves was in a down point at that time, and I wasn't a huge Keanu Reeves fan. He had done Speed, like, 3 years earlier, 2 years earlier, and then had some bad decisions. But I liked the film a lot. I met my wife about a year later, and I think she had seen the film by then, or if, I don't remember if she had seen it or if I had shown it to her. But I knew she was a fan of the film at some point, early into our relationship. I watched it several times then, and then it sort of seems to have become a film that I think nobody talks about anymore, and I don't quite know why.
I think, you know, it's maybe the release. I mean, it's just a crappy release. I mean,
yeah, but if they sensed there was a demand for it, I mean, Pacino's no longer Pacino, right? The demand for his stuff isn't there anymore, really.
No. So he's still got a draw, though. But, he just sent people wild at E3.
Right, I know that. And so that's the one that, and Shirley, Charlize Theron has, you know, made a name for herself since then.
Right.
So,
and Connie Nielsen was in Gladiator and was the lead in Red Planet and a bunch of other films too. And then, but yeah, she got older. She's now like 50 something, and she was in Wonder Woman, as a matter of fact. So yeah, there's some big actors in it.
Yeah. So it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me why it isn't a bigger film. Whatever. I mean, it did well at the time. So what I mean by, again, in bigger film is, like, it doesn't seem like it has a legacy following in the same way that some older films have. In fact, a lot of the 90s seems to be in a weird spot, because in the digital revolution, people are rushing to maybe get collector's edition of movies from the 80s and earlier, but they're really not doing anything with the stuff from the 90s.
Well,
it's like
the 90s
too recent to be classic, but it's not recent enough that it just automatically got, like, you know, a 4K remastering and immediately dropped onto disc, you know, 6 months after it was released.
Well, the 90s, in my thoughts, was just a little bit weird in movie times, because in my estimation, a lot of films from the 90s that should have gotten more recognition didn't. And I often wonder, and this is just something I think about, is, you know, we were all teenagers in the 80s, right? All of us now, except for Abe. He's not on tonight. But we were all teenagers in the 80s, so we glommed to this. But once the 90s started happening, there was kind of a shift of social change on a lot of different levels. And those of us who had been teens in the 80s kind of went to college and shifted our focus away from things. And, you know, that was when the millennials were kind of being born. And I just think there was kind of a social shift where there wasn't such a focus on the films. Also, the 90s kind of ushered in the big, you can own the movie age. it kind of started in the mid-80s, but only if you had enough money, right? Because we all remember when we bought VHSs, it was like $100 to buy a VHS.
For the first year or so.
Right. In the 90s, especially in the early 90s, the VHSs became more rentable. Blockbuster was a lot more popular, even than it was in the mid-80s, and the movies became more affordable. And so I think in the early 90s, people started to say, like particularly young people, I can wait for that. But in the 80s, we didn't have that. So that's why I think it kind of changed, if that makes any sense, because people could wait for it. And then things started to speed up. You know, in the 80s, and even in the 70s, a movie was in the theaters for 3, 6, 9 months, almost a year. So Jaws, I think, was in the theaters for like almost 2 years. Once we got into the early 90s, that time frame started to shorten because the studios saw there was a opportunity to make money on VHS and DVD and Blu-ray and even Beta. Who remembers Beta? But we have a Beta player. But anyway, there was more money to be made on the home video market. And that's why I think things started to shift and things in the 90s just kind of got ignored.
Yeah, I think the big shift, because it used to be about a year, right? So I remember like Who Framed Roger Rabbit came in 1988 and it was available on VHS about a year later for $20, $25, $30. The big shift, I think, was probably Batman because that came out in June. And they knew that they had a hot hand, so they released it for like 1999 that Christmas. So that really shifted that window to a 6 months release span. And that started
Was really pushing
that. That was 89, right? That was the very end of the 80s.
Yep.
And then people would get upset. Like I think Ghost came out was that the same summer or the following summer? And people were pissed because they saw Ghost is coming on VHS and they wanted to buy it because they could buy Batman for $19.99. Why couldn't they buy Ghost for $19.99? It was $100. So because it was being sold to the rental chains, right? Because once you sold the copy to Blockbuster, you know, you lost that money and nobody else was going to buy it. So you made sure Blockbuster paid through the nose for the rental purchase.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, and so for whatever reason, that movie or this movie and some other films that are owned by major film studios don't get a fancier or more proper release, I don't know. There's a curiosity, like this is a film that, you know, could be lent out to like a Scream Factory or something, but maybe it's too weird of a horror film to do that for. In other words, maybe these boutique labels don't see it as a big seller, and then Hollywood, Universal, whatever, that released this film, just doesn't see the value of making it a HD transfer new release or something. I don't know. I mean, obviously,
I hope Screen Factory gets their hands on it at some point.
That would be awesome, yeah. I mean, I know Keanu Reeves could be there and someone will suddenly look at it and go, Keanu Reeves, this may be a film that could give us some extra money if we put it out. It's a cult film, has a blood and boobs and monsters. It's got
Warner Brothers film, so that should have the backing.
Yeah, exactly. And Warner Brothers has been releasing a lot of their older films like the 50s and 60s in boutique format. I mean, they release it directly, but they're, you know, selling them for like $20 to $24 and re-releasing them with extras and all that stuff. So it would be one that they could do. I know they had that one issue with one scene where there's a statue that is, I guess this is not really a spoiler, but it comes to life in a sense, and the actual artist of the statue was pissed that they did it without telling him, so that cut of the film has changed. Me and Eric have the original cut, and then they released a second disc, you know, 10 years later that doesn't have it, so they cut out certain scenes, you know, like maybe it's like 20 seconds when the statue comes alive. So
yeah. Well, it's that's interesting because we actually have that second cut, I think, Phil.
Okay.
Because when I watched it on DVD, now there's like three commentaries on the DVD I have, or two or three, and they're excellent. I listen to them all. But I agree with you because there was a very big controversy about that that statue moment. And apparently nobody has actually released the full cut of the original. Like, even the director's cut that you and Eric have, that's not the full cut of the way it really was, according to what I've read on. Yeah, it's not even the full cut. The actual full original theatrical cut of that particular scene that you're talking about has never been released. That is my understanding. I did some research on it, but anyway.
Interesting. So yeah, I mean, I don't know why the film hasn't had a more proper release, and why the film hasn't, you know, kept it hasn't been left kept in the public eye, to be honest, which is kind of odd. I don't know. Six Degrees to Kevin Bacon. Both Charlize Theron and Connie Nielsen were offered to play Wonder Woman's mom in the last Wonder Woman film, and Charlize Theron turned it down, and Connie Nielsen took it. So that's kind of interesting.
We might actually have a direct tie to Kevin Bacon. I believe, was it Charlize Theron? I gotta look this up. I think she may have been in a movie with Kevin Bacon called Trapped.
Oh, interesting. How about that? So, I have never heard of that film, Eric. That's kind of interesting. I follow both
yeah,
Kevin
I just
Bacon
found
and
it.
Charlize Theron.
And here's what makes me sad.
Charlize Theron, Courtney Love, and Kevin Bacon were in a movie together. And Dakota Fanning, called Trapped. Huh. I actually like that movie. It came out in 2002.
And how many millennials actually understand 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon? That's what I'd like to know.
Yeah, they probably don't even know who Kevin Bacon is.
Yeah, there you go.
Even though I guess he has a new show on Showtime. That's
Kevin
really awesome.
Bacon? That's I have a plant-based say. Diet.
Yeah, but someone texted me just a couple hours ago and asked if I had seen on Showtime his new show. You watched that new show, City on the Hill, based in Boston, starring Kevin Bacon. Good stuff. It's a combination of The Wire meets The Departed. So it sounds interesting. I don't subscribe to Showtime, so that's why you can see it. All right, Eric, do we have a wiki?
Wiki. Somebody's breathing loudly into their microphone.
Yeah, I think Mike.
I'm not breathing.
Well, it was interesting because while you were talking, we would get this. Your voice was like very heavy, and then
I wonder it's hitting my hitting whiskers. I don't know. Move the mic away a little bit from maybe that helps.
Yeah, and then
there we go.
There we go. Okay, so we have Eric.
Wiki. An exceptionally adept Florida lawyer is offered a job at a high-end New York City law firm with a high-end boss, the biggest opportunity of his career to date. I kind of like that wiki. That's really misleading.
That is awesome because it doesn't say anything about anything. It just says right. That lawyer in some small town, which isn't really that small. It's Gainesville. It's a pretty decent-sized town. Is invited to come to New York and work there, and that's it.
Yep.
Says nothing.
So should we throw up a spoiler alert at this point?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we pretty much discussed a lot of stuff before the spoiler alert. Anything else anybody wanted to bring up before the spoiler alert? Anything? All right, so we'll throw up the spoiler alert. So it's good. Works for us. And we will talk about everything and anything. For folks who are interested in seeing this film at present, which is June 13th, 2019, the film is available for free on Netflix. So if someone's listening to this episode a year later from now, obviously it may not be there. But there is a disc that you can buy pretty cheap on Amazon, but it's not.
But I think all of us recommend it, and you should check it out. And there's no huge twist in this movie. It's actually fairly predictable, but you might want to watch it before you hear spoilers.
And there you go.
Al Pacino's the devil. Just. In case
right.
For some reason you missed the title and the commercials and the trailer and
yeah, or the blurb the,
the various scenes of Al Pacino standing in front of a huge fire going hoo-ha or whatever he was doing back then.
Yeah.
That's not the only line he ever had, Mike.
I did read when I was doing reviews and all that, you know, reading stuff about it, like Chrissy was reading stuff about it. I did find out that it's one of the most popular films on the MrSkin.com website because of Connie Nielsen and Charlize Theron.
I can believe that.
Yes, I can too, actually, yes. This is like one of those last hurrah when Hollywood would have fairly strong nudity in films before it moved pretty much to HBO.
And there's frontal nudity for Tomorrow to Me, too.
Yes.
Which always shocks me when I revisit the movie because she's the medical examiner on Law & Order SVU.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I had never seen that show, and then when my parents were watching it, the movie, they said, "Oh, that's you know whatever her name is from that TV show." So, mm-hmm. So that was interesting, and I think that's maybe her only nude scene too.
It wouldn't surprise me if that's
yeah. I don't remember
she hasn't really been a movie star. She's really just a TV star. What's that, Mike?
Oh, so I don't remember what podcast I was listening to, but they're basically talking about how. Like nudity is like death now in Hollywood. Like if you want,
I don't think it was a podcast. I think it was when we were interviewing Garo Nagojin.
Yes.
Was it? No, it yeah. wasn't.
You said it too.
Where he said that. Where he said like they didn't want to hear anything or say. Yeah, that was it. Yes. Okay, that was it. So it was a podcast. It was just hours before it was released.
Okay. Yes. Fair enough.
Yes. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And that makes sense. I mean, unless it's cable. Pay TV, you can't really do it anymore. Very curious.
Well, you can, but it's not in your own best interest.
Yes, yes, right. It'll be a flop at the theaters for some reason. Unless you're in Europe. In Europe, they love that stuff. All right.
Well, I'm wondering if there's like fear of being told that they're like misogynistic if they show boobs or something.
Well, there's that, and it's also just a weird American thing. Apparently, it's cool to watch all the people die in all sorts of hideously violent ways, but if you see a boob, then that's a disaster.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Very interesting situation.
Okay, and I think
that's
we
actually had this discussion, I think, when we were
more than once,
Straw Dogs. Yeah, when we exactly.
We've had this discussion more than once. Yes,
yes. All right, so let's get into this film and start talking about it. So Keanu Reeves actually is the lead actor, even though it has a pretty strong ensemble cast. As I said before, Charlize Theron and Connie Nielsen were just beginning their careers. Oddly, Jeffrey Jones is in this film prior to his legal troubles, and he had a pretty big role in it, too. And he was a guy that would be in every film until his legal issues. And then, of course, Al Pacino, Academy Award-nominated actor, and I can't remember if this was before he won the Academy Award for when he played the blind guy from New Hampshire. What's that? The Spell
of a Woman.
Yeah, yeah. So it was during that same period, though, when he was his career was being rejuvenated. All right, so let's discuss. How do we want to discuss this? So this is a Faustian tale, right? Right. This is really what it is.
According to Wikipedia, yes.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. For folks who don't know what Faustian tale is, that there was actually the first time I ever heard of it was because when I was younger, my father had this. Opera and classical music book, and I used to read it all the time just because I was weird. One of the big operas or musics from one of the big classical people, and I can't even remember who it was, did one on Faust, and I read the blurb about what the story is, and it's basically a guy that sells his soul to the devil for fame and fortune, basically. I think that's where it comes from, right?
I've never read Faust, but that sounds about right.
Right. And we've seen this in many movies, B-movies, regular movies, whatever, and this is similar to that, I guess. Any comments by anybody? I know, Mike, you and Chrissy, you sometimes have some interesting points when it comes to stuff like this. Anything?
I guess not.
Not right now.
Well, I mean, what is it you're specifically asking?
Literary references.
It's a Faustian deal, right? I mean,
oh my lord! I mean, I have so many things to talk about with this film in regard to a lot of levels and a lot of things. I mean, you know, there is the whole thing about William Blake that's in here. The references to, you know, of course, Paradise Lost. I don't know if anybody's watched read Paradise Lost and understands it. There's a lot of stuff in here. I mean, this is actually a very complicated film. If you wished to take it that way, there are a lot of things going on. And the director himself, you know, he said, we have the DVD version where there's all these commentaries. And so I literally spent a whole day watching the film again and then listening to each commentary and just really gleaning a lot of things that were very much done deliberately. And I know a lot on this podcast, we talk about what is the difference between seeing things and what did the writer, artist, / filmmaker really intend. The commentary on this, particularly by the director, is awesome. He definitely points out very specific things that he did on purpose, that he did intentionally. And so this is an example of one of those movies that if you think you see a level in there, yeah, you actually saw it. Because he comes right out in the commentary and says, I did this for this reason, and I chose this color for this reason, and it's fascinating. So what did you guys want to know? I mean, did you want to talk about William Blake, the William Blake painting in Paradise Lost? I mean, I'm not quite sure where you want me to start.
Well, as we get into specific plot points, all that stuff begins to come up anyway. So I guess we can start the plot. Eric, let's do that
and then we can
bring in this stuff as we go on.
The beginning of the movie is pretty straightforward. Keanu Reeves is a lawyer in Florida who has never lost a case, and he is in the middle of a trial defending a accused child molester. And basically, he figures out a way to win the case, even though he is fairly certain the man is guilty. So he does that, and then he gets offered to visit New York, where he meets Al Pacino, who offers him a job at his big fancy law firm in New York. And Keanu Reeves' mother really does not want him to do that. She is a very religious person, and warns him about the sin of the city, as it were. And his wife seems fairly enthusiastic about it, until they get there. And then her tune changes a little bit once they're in New York. So he takes the job in New York at this huge law firm run by Al Pacino.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things that's interesting about all this is that the wife is the one that really wants to push him to go. I mean, you know, she's the one that wants the new life, the fun city and all that.
The fortune.
Fortune, glory, partying and all that. And he's more apt to just take the paycheck and then head back to Florida. And when he gets there, the job really is only a one-time or two-time job where he's supposed to pick the jury for a case. And all the associates of this law firm think it's insane. Why are you bringing this no-name Gainesville lawyer? And sure, he wins a bunch of cases down there, but what makes him so special to be able to pick a jury when you have all these Harvard and BC and BU and Northwestern lawyers at these big this big law firm that can do the job anyway. And it turns out that he has a knack somehow, like almost like another
sixth sense,
that's the word I'm looking for, thank you. And it's not supernatural or anything, but I mean, he just has.
Or is it?
Right, right. But he has this feeling that he can tell, and they show an example when they're choosing a jury about how you don't want this woman because you can. I can tell that she is a pissed off person, and that she is actually would hurt our case. And the lawyer thinks he's insane, and he just says, "Well, I just can feel it." And then after the case goes well and he was correct and he picked a great jury, they offer him a job, and his wife wants him to take it because, again, it's huge money and all this other stuff. So, yeah, that's what exactly right, Eric, about the mother thinking, you know, it's the quote-unquote sinful city, and here he is going to New York, and he's going to be rubbing elbows. This, you know, I don't want to say
with the devil.
Yeah, no, white trash, but from it comes from menial beginnings, and he is now going to be with the elites and at a parties with senators. And all that, and it was kind of interesting that Al D'Amato and a couple other people have cameos in the film, because obviously the person that's having the parties, we find out, will be an unsavory individual, and they actually decided. I mean, again, it's just a movie, but it's just ironic that real people in politics decided to be make cameos in the film. All right, so. Anybody else have any comments about any of this stuff? Because me and Eric have only really said much, but Eric, you may have some stuff too to say.
Not a whole lot. This is just pretty much the setup for the story in New York City.
Well, I think there are a lot of hints given about the fact that we're dealing with the devil here. They're all very subtle, and these are all presented right in the middle. They're right up in the up front. There's Pentaplaza.
Like the title?
Yeah, well, besides the title, there's Pentaplaza, for example. Penta from Pentagram.
I didn't notice that, Christine, until this last rewatch before we recorded. I never noticed
exactly.
Pentaplaza before.
There's a lot of subtle stuff. The number 5, in terms of Penta... Right,
yep, five,
is very significant in the Bible on many levels. There are 5 books of the law in the Old Testament. The number 5 also signifies God's grace. There are several other ways it's significant as well, in connection with God or the heavens as opposed to the devil. But I think in this particular case with the film, because the director did mention this, they were just going for the connection to the pentagram. It's also mentioned that Pacino spends a lot of his time in the air. There's that one line. Satan is considered the prince of the air. That is, you know, in biblical context. I'm sure Kevin Letts can fill us in on all this, but he is the prince of the air. The devil's name, of course, is John Milton. That's the character's name.
Who
wrote Paradise Lost. And if you know anything about Paradise Lost, for those of you who don't know, listeners, real fast, Paradise Lost is considered an epic poem, actually, and it was written in the mid to the late 1600s. So this would have been right around the time of, you know, the bubonic plagues in London, the fire, okay, the Great London Fire. But it's really the story, in terms of Paradise Lost, it's the story of Adam and Eve being tempted and kind of falling out of God's favor, Falling from Grace. And that's kind of what happens to Lomax and his wife in this story. Paradise Lost has some really interesting intersections with this film. I know they were on purpose because the director did talk about these, although he didn't talk about them in the depth that I'm going to talk about them. There's one point in Paradise Lost. Oh, shit. Hold on. Let me remember. Satan gets scared off by the appearance of the golden scales of justice. I'm not exactly sure what the impetus was for that because I don't totally remember. But the golden scales of justice appear in the sky. And Satan gets frightened off by that. And here in this film, Lomax is a lawyer. And just about everybody in this movie is a lawyer. And it has to do with this movie, I think, is a great comment on corruption in the legal system. And, you know, to become a lawyer, you're always like, why don't you be a lawyer? I think the trope in all the Hollywood films and in all the books and in everything we've seen is, hey, become a lawyer, you'll make money. So it's kind of connected to that. But also getting back to Pacino as the devil, one of the lines that Pacino says is, that's our secret. I will kill you with kindness. And when you look at the Bible, that is what a lot of Christians believe and hold sacred, and it's what I held sacred as a kid, that the devil truly is the prince of lies. He tempts you with everything nice and pretty, and then he brings the hammer down. And so this is really one of those movies where if you know the big reveal, and if you figure it out, and you know what's at the end, you can go back to the beginning of this film, listen to what Al Pacino as the devil says, and like every word out of his mouth, he practically tells you he's the devil. You know, he says, I'm small. People underestimate me. But we also have, on the part of the Pacino, there are moments in which you can catch him moving his tongue like a snake. I mean, there's a lot here. So I don't know. Did I add anything to this conversation? It's really pretty obvious, and it's brilliant. Because you know what? It could be considered heavy-handed in any other film, Eric, but they kind of did it in places where you're watching other things. So you catch it out of the corner of your eye. It's not like, here I am licking my tongue like licking my lips like a snake. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh shit, did I just see that tongue come out? It's so well done. And that's what Paradise Lost is all about. That, you know, the undertones in the original Paradise Lost, and if there's anybody out there who'd like to read it, the language is difficult. Do what I did. Get the cliff notes. Read the freaking cliff notes. Understand what's going on. Then go try to tackle the original language. It's not of our time. So it's difficult. And that's cool. Just the important thing is that you understand what's happening in it. But, you know, that's what John Milton does. Everything he does in there is subtle but not subtle. Eric, just like you were laughing about. So.
Right. And to be honest, even though it isn't subtle, that's okay. And because obviously, you know, the title, but also because at this time in Hollywood and a lot of times even today, characters like Gordon Gekko and in this case, Milton and others are so slimy and dirty and, I guess, quote unquote, evil, with little amoral people, that to not be that subtle, I guess it doesn't even matter, because I mean, whether it's the drug dealer in Traffic or Gordon Gekko in Wall Street or the actual literal devil in this film, it's all the same. It's a commentary on money and power and I guess womanizing or cheating in general, if you prefer, based, you know, if we change the sexes of the lead character and all these other things that are temptations that really just can make people's lives, quote unquote, more enjoyable, but it's also self-destructive behavior and also insensitive behavior, as you know, whether it's the 1% or whether it's just the rock and roller or a bohemian artist or anybody. I mean, it's just an interesting take on a lifestyle that can be considered corrupt, I guess.
It can be considered corrupt, and it can also be idolized. Because a lot of people, if you offered them that life, they would take you up on it. And that's actually part of what makes this movie so good, is that, as Chrissy was talking about earlier, Al Pacino, the devil, doesn't make Neil Lomax do anything. He just lays a path out in front of him to see if he'll take it. And as they have the conversation at the end of the movie, it's all about free will. He has to make the choice to go down that path. And I thought that was the most interesting aspect of this movie.
Well, I mean, it's not a sin if it's something that you're forced to do, right? I mean, mm-hmm. You know, it's, you know, if somebody comes out of the blue and punches you in the face, you can't, you know, blame somebody for fighting back, you know, but it's when you can be led into doing it yourself. And I mean, I laugh at some of it because it's such a very, I guess it's very predictable.
Right.
Right. It's well crafted, don't get me wrong, but it's very predictable. It's and a lot of old tropes, you know, the obvious trope of, you know, all the evil and sins and temptation of the big city, as opposed mm-hmm. to, you know, the purity of the small towns, which, if you live in small towns, we have a smaller concentration of sin, but it's still there. because everything's in a smaller concentration.
Mm.
The idea that there's a lawyer who would somehow be caught unaware of the fact that he might possibly represent someone who is bad. you know, the defense attorneys, don't get suckered into representing bad people. They are well aware that they may be representing somebody.
Yeah, they volunteer to represent bad people.
Well, they volunteer to represent people. And part of the whole point of the system we have is adversarial, you know, so it's not like it's and the idea is that everybody deserves a defense. Now, the attorney I work with, he'll say he doesn't ask because he knows they'll lie to him. You know, he won't say, are you guilty? Because he'll know they'll lie. And even if uh-huh. they don't lie to him, they're just those people in Shawshank Redemption, you know, who all say that they're innocent.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, you'll have people who are guilty who just believe they're innocent. So they don't even ask. So it's just weird that they do that, and, you know, you look at the case he has at the beginning of the film. Yeah, the guy he's defending clearly is a pervert, he's at least a pervert, whether he's a pedophile
well,
or not.
He actually believes he's innocent until he sees him getting turned on during
but
the trial.
But we also know the girl sets him up, right? Or does, or right, that, and that's the problem with it. You know, it's that, you know, it's, I mean, it's the, you can do the flip side. This was like right after O.J. Simpson, right? 86, 96 rather.
Yeah. Well, actually O.J. Simpson was 30 years ago, wasn't he? Oh no. Yeah. He was 20 years
ago. It was after.
Yeah.
It was right after. But like, you know, the whole thing with Mark Furman, right? For Mark Furman, did you ever say the N word? Nope. And then they find the audio tape and dropping all the N bombs. Well, now suddenly you throw doubt on everything that he says.
Right.
And everything that he might've done. So, When you have those things, they're not minor things. When the only witness you have admits to getting other people to lie on the stand, that's not justice isn't done, but it's also protections of the legal system to help prevent innocent people from being railroaded.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a weird thing, but we all have this like gut instinct of, you know, oh well, fuck the people who've been accused or fuck the people we think are guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very much clearly dealing with a very, so it's weird that this is a world or a little universe that they've concocted here where it does actually dance very much in black and white. It doesn't see things quite in nuance or shades of gray.
But what I was referring to when I was talking about the choices that Keanu Reeves' character makes is, you know, leaving his wife alone, you know, boss suggests that they go get a drink. He doesn't have to go get a drink, but is implied that it might be best if he goes gets a drink. And little things like that that just keep on adding up,
right,
and adding up, leading to his wife feeling abandoned and harming his marriage.
Well, and I'm curious if this was intentional or not. If in real life he was, I think Keanu Reeves was like 31 or so at the time the film was made.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you, Charlize Theron was 22,
right?
And Connie Nielsen was 32, and Keanu Reeves was, if I can bring his name up, I don't even know how to spell his name, Keanu, okay, there it is, Keanu Reeves was 33.
All right, so there's an 11-year difference between the actors. I don't know if there was supposed to be that difference between the characters.
Probably not. I mean, Connie Nielsen, him, and Charlize Theron were probably, in theory, for the movie, this around the same age. You just think they were all like 28, but obviously the actors obviously were different ages. Yeah.
Right, because I'm just thinking if that was intentional or not, because obviously if you have a 22-year-old girl married to a 33-year-old man, there's a big disparity in that relationship there. Because that age difference maybe doesn't such a big deal at like 42 and 52, but it's a big deal 32 to 22, or a bigger deal. Although not as big as 22 and 12, but but we've all had jobs, and there's always some politics that go with it. And when you just get that job, when the boss says something, you don't say no. Not if you want to keep the job.
Right.
You know, you're trying to make a good impression.
You want to play the game, and you don't want to burn your bridges on mistake.
Right. And so he said, you know, and, you know, if you're in a legal profession, sort of going to functions and going and doing that stuff, it's a part of it. It's a part of the game. You know, you have to make contacts. You have to make connections. It's how, and you're supposed to be bringing clients into the firm. That's how you do those things. So did he have a choice? Yeah. But that goes with the territory. It goes with the job. And his wife really ought to have known that, too. Right, especially since she's the one who's pushing for bigger and better things. That's how bigger and better things happen. And, you know, not to get sexist about this, but it's always been a thing for men that work takes them away from the family. Women have the issue of the stereotype is the woman trying to juggle home and family, home and work, you know, work and family. Where men, it's always more an issue of throwing themselves into the work and losing their family or abandoning the family, depending on how you perceive it. So it's a weird thing that it was she was making that big of an issue out of it, because I would kind of expect it for a young lawyer.
And that's the thing is that a lot of these decisions, it's even though he has a choice, as Eric said, it's also if he wants his career to work, if he does the wrong thing, he's screwed, because even though he's tempted to cheat and tempted to do all these other things, he never actually ever steps over the line, even though he may think it. So everything that he has to do that ruins his marriage and ruins his personal life is to make sure that he does the job. In other words, he's not like Charlie Sheen's character in Wall Street, where he really just jumps in and the Wolf of Wall Street, Leonardo DiCaprio's character, where they just jump in and they want to live that life and they don't give a rat's ass about everything else. He does care about his personal life and his wife. It's just that he has this weird balancing act between his job and his personal life. And so his sins, in my opinion, aren't as bad as the sins we would see by the normal person, which is what you said, Eric, which is, oh, if I could have that life, I would do that immediately, which is really more like the Charlie Sheen or Leonardo DiCaprio roles in Wall Street and The Wolf of Wall Street. So his sins are more circumstantial, I felt, rather than selfishness or being evil or being a hedonist or whatever other term you want to use. And I thought that was kind of interesting. And also, I also thought what was interesting is that everything was by choice and making it him choose. I mean, like, for example, Keanu Reeves also was in Dracula, and there's the scene where he's being, I guess, molested by the hot vampire girls. But whether or not he, like say, a spy who turns because they're offered sex, you know, prostitutes or money, he turned in as Dracula because he was, it wasn't free will. It's because, you know, vampires can you know, charm you. So here it had nothing to do with charming, even though, you know, Milton is a charmer. It really had to do with him thinking what was best for his family, even if it was burning the bridges with his family, because he thinks, you know, if he gets a better job and stays in good with the boss, his family survives. And I don't think he was doing it for selfish reasons. Am I wrong?
No, I think
it was both.
It's a little bit, I mean, it's there. He's being tempted by it. He goes there. He's flattered, right? He's a show-off. He's very confident in his abilities. But again, he's a young guy who's, you know, he's got the hot hand. You know, most of us, if we were had that kind of success he would have, we'd be a little full of ourselves too. It's not undeserved success. You know, he gets tested right away, and, you know, walks, and he's right. He's absolutely right. He goes up to a big-time attorney in a big-time law firm and says,
I can play with you
jury.
Guys.
Not only can I play with you, I can play better than you. That right. If you go with that juror, it's a fucking mistake.
Yep. Yeah.
Right? And he very quickly gets handed the keys to the castle. He's the golden boy. You know, that's going to go to anybody's head. But the problem is I never really get a sense that he's getting lost. I get the sense that he's maybe whipped up in things, right? That he's kind of like a lot of us do. You get caught up in just the day-to-day in your life, in your work. But I would have maybe liked it a little bit more if he got – or maybe it would the moral dilemma wasn't as much as I think it could have been. Do you follow?
Yes.
No, I do follow that. I think – that one of the things that this movie did exceptionally well is that we see his subtle destruction. You know, we see Keanu Reeves' introduction to this world. He is seduced by the money. He is seduced by, you know, we live in this beautiful apartment. We have all this stuff. And look, I have earned this. But really, he kind of, I mean, he has earned it, but he hasn't, because he is, obviously, we find out later, the son of the devil. So he's already been kind of groomed for this. But the way that this film kind of showed it was very subtly. If you look at the way his clothes, you know, transform, subtle things like his clothes, they transform through the film. You know, look at his shoes. His shoes are different. I'm talking about Keanu Reeves here. It's a very subtle change. And so I'd have to agree with Mike in that I don't know if I'd agree so much with what was it you guys were saying, where that he was making deliberate things to gain more money. I agree with Mike in that I don't think he was. But I don't think I agree with Mike so much in that he didn't know it was happening. I think he knew what was going on, but he wanted that so badly. And as things increased and as things got more intense, it was not just for his family and not just for a better life. It was also for him. And there was sort of like a subtle takeover, which I think is very true of capitalism. I mean, I do work – in a financial services office. I've been there for 20 years. I have seen brokers come in when they are nothing. Nothing. They have no clients. They have no prospects. They're struggling. They're making the minimum hour wage. You know, Phil, you had mentioned movies like Wall Street. You know, that's very typical. And then they sort of somehow start getting one thing after another, and it just sort of comes very quickly. And then they get bitten by the bug, and their personalities changed. And I have worked with these people sometimes for 20 years. And it is only the best of them that are truly happy in their own lives and with themselves that are not tempted and do not change. But I have seen many that have used to be wonderful people, and now they're just, I'm sorry, complete assholes, and I want nothing to do with them.
Well,
so,
and in this movie here, Chrissy, that's part of what I like about this movie, is that it all gets laid out. It's all the choices that he makes. And then at the end of the movie, the devil throws it in his face. And probably one of my favorite moments of the entire movie is when Al Pacino as the devil literally makes Keanu Reeves' voice come out of his mouth and repeats something that he said earlier to throw it in his back in his face. Like, hey, you had a choice. You made the choice, and now you got to live with the choice.
Well, I think what I was like, yeah, I think, and actually, I think that's the devil's mistake. I think what I was trying to say, Chrissy, it's that he doesn't know what he's doing, in that he doesn't know, he's not deliberately abandoning his wife. He's getting caught up in work. It's the same practical effect. He's just not aware necessarily of the effect he's having on those around him. He's not aware of where he's being tempted. And I think the problem with the devil at the end is that he puts his cards on the table, and that makes him aware of what's going on, right? So if he had not done anything, right? If he had not said, "Look at all the shit you've been doing, you know, look at everything you've done. You've been drinking from the Kool-Aid for, you know, the last 2 hours of this film,"
mm-hmm.
then he might have gone even further down that path of corruption and temptation than he actually did,
right?
Also,
I'm saying whenever he was presented with a choice to do the right thing, he tended to do the right thing. It was when he wasn't consciously making a choice that we kind of go down that path of corruption.
Also, I do. Also, yeah. I felt that him being married changes everything as well, because had he not been married, he would have just been like a... Derek Jeter or Leonardo DiCaprio or someone like that, who's young and either will never get married or will get married in their 40s. And they're doing no harm to anybody until they start cheating on their spouse, for example. And so here... he wasn't doing anything. I mean, obviously there was some cases like, you know, the pedophile and did the guy really murder his wife? And you know, but he doesn't know that necessarily. Like you said, Mike, you know, lawyers don't know necessarily, and they don't ask questions. And in this movie, it makes it appear that he really doesn't know. You know, it's not like he's being ignorant and intentionally. So when everything goes down the hill, his wife's breakdown occurs, but it's not because he's actually cheating on her, and it's not because he's actually being uncaring. It's I guess more like what Chrissy said, which is maybe there's a little self love there, where, you know, I can be the best ever, and that's awesome, whatnot. But I think a lot of the film really plays it out as if he's concerned that if he screws up, it will, you know, where he turns down his boss, it's going to piss off his boss, and then he'll fall out of favor. And whether or not that's because of his narcissism, or if it's because he's worried about his family and the job, it's still, I guess, not as bad as those other characters.
To a certain point, I agree with you, but then it gets to the point where there's that one scene where they're walking down the street, and his wife is clearly having some sort of breakdown, And Al Pacino says to him, hey, go take care of your wife. This is important. Everybody will understand. And even after being given that out, he still does not do it.
That's true. That's true.
Good point. Forgot about that.
Well, because there's this whole thing there about kind of like Star Wars, like being seduced by the dark side. Success is a drug. You know, you've worked all your life to get that success. I mean, here was this lawyer in this little podunk town who had all the success, and then he was courted, just like you guys said, and oh my gosh, he's handed all this wonderful stuff. Now he's finally got his success, and now it's bitten him like a drug, right? And so there was always that fear when you were on that pinnacle and you've reached that pinnacle of success, you're on that pedestal, that if I breathe the wrong way, I could lose this. And this is not an unreasonable fear. I mean, we look at things like the way you perceive people, right? We look at O.J. Simpson, right? Everybody loved him. He was on a pedestal, and then bang, look at all this bad stuff that came out about him.
Just
so,
one little thing.
Right, and it takes one
anniversary.
Little thing.
It's the
you
anniversary
kill
this
one
week.
Person.
Wow.
Two people.
Two.
Kill two people.
Yeah, don't forget Gold.
But it could. But my point is, it could even be less than that. You know, there's a thing. I worked for years in marketing and public relations, and damage control specifically. And I learned from the best. She was crazy. She was out of her mind, off her ass, insane. But she knew her shit. And one of the things she always told me was, it takes 20 years to build a great reputation. It takes one fuck up in 5 minutes to destroy it.
True.
And this is what I saw in this movie with Keanu Reeves in that moment where the devil offered, where Al Pacino said, go take care of your wife. That was Keanu Reeves. The reason he didn't make that choice is shit. All it takes is one tiny thing to destroy what I have. And he doesn't know what that tiny thing is. Because, okay, maybe he didn't understand that this was the devil, but at that point in the film, he was already having some misgivings. So he really doesn't know who he's dealing with. So the way that I took that was he's kind of protecting himself. That was the way I took it. But anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, and that makes sense. That's the thing is that I think the film is more interesting because it's more ambiguous than say Wall Street or The Wolf of Wall Street, where you pretty much know these guys are dirtbags. And here, is he a dirtbag, or is he just screwing up? Because you know, obviously his wife turns into mental illness, and a lot of it was caused, or part of it was caused by Milton, because Milton tells her to cut her hair and dye her hair and all this other stuff. In other words, he planted seeds to kind of destroy her anyway. And so Keanu Reeves not being home a lot because, you know, he's at this new law firm or whatever. So similar to like The Firm and Tom Cruise. I mean, there's another example. He doesn't see his wife's dramatic change. And then by the time he does figure it out, he's like you said, Chrissy, he's now worried about his job as well. And it may even be too late and stuff. So And also, he's still being tempted by this lifestyle, right? Because he has the fantasy that he's screwing Connie Nielsen's character when he's actually having sex with his own wife. And she knows that he's not necessarily, she doesn't know what he's thinking, but she knows that he's not actually there in the moment, because again they do this interesting split screen where whenever they roll over for a new position, it switches from Connie Nielsen back to Charlize Theron and back to Connie Nielsen and so forth.
Well, and I think
I was just gonna say, at this point Connie Nielsen is a model and Charlize Theron has already become, even though she's a model in real life too, they've downed her big time in this film at that point, because she isn't the sex pot that she was in the earlier part of the film.
Well, and I think honestly that was probably one, and still is, it's high up there in my list of one of the most intense sex scenes ever. And also, strangely, one of the most realistic, because one of the themes in this movie is the difference between perception and truth. But another one of the themes in this movie is the difference between fantasy and reality. And most literary themes will be stated in one word, right? It's fantasy, or it's justice, or it's beauty, or it's youth. I think this film makes it a little more complicated. And I think the reason that sex scene was so intense was because it actually works on a couple of different levels, right? You're talking about the difference between perception, right? Who she's fucking. She's thinks she's making love to her husband, but who is he really? You know, her reality. But also, it's the difference between what was the second thing I said? I was saying perception and reality, and then I was saying what was the second thing?
Fantasy.
Yes, thank you. Fantasy and reality. How many of us, and you guys do not have to answer, but I'll just say it. How many of us have gone to bed with other people, with our husbands or our girlfriends or whoever we're with, and fantasized about other individuals? And I think that's why that sex scene is so intense and so universal. It is one of the most intense sex scenes in the Hollywood film world, and I looked it up, and yes, there's other people talking about this too, because it's a giant metaphor for what we actually want and what we actually get. And that also ties into the other central, one of the central themes in the film, is that, you know, what do you want and how far are you willing to go to get it? Does that make any sense?
Yes, it sure does.
Eric?
Yeah, Mike?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm here. No, we got it.
Well, anybody have comments on it? I guess some other folks are quiet.
I understand where she was coming from. I didn't realize she was done.
Gotcha.
There's this other. Okay, so everything Chrissy just said is completely valid, but there's a moment in the movie where I just want to get all your takes on it. Where that Charlize Theron claims that she was raped by John Milton, and Keanu Reeves says that's impossible. He was in court with me, and then she disrobes to reveal all these cuts all over her body, look like scratches or whatever. So the question is, do you think that Al Pacino used his devilly tricks to remotely rape her, or did she harm herself?
I actually, that's the thing, is that since Keanu Reeves is in a world that is not supernatural, he thinks she's just mentally ill at this point, because, you know, losing it. Because obviously when she says it was John and it was this afternoon, he flips out because he says, that's not true. I was with him all this afternoon. He could not have done this. Obviously you're sick or you're lying. You need help. And then when she pulls the robe off and we see all these cuts throughout her body, it's a full frontal scene. So you literally, it's all up and down her body. He thinks she did it to herself, and that makes sense, because again, he doesn't live in a supernatural world. He sees his wife mentally ill, completely broken, and doing self-harm to herself now. And it's left ambiguous whether or not it was Milton or if she did self-harm, because they never show a scene.
Right.
Where
they don't show the actual rape happening.
Or actual self-mutilation.
Right.
So, because again, you know, whether it was the devil's, my guess, it was the devil's trick. So the question is.
Yeah, that's my guess too.
But it could be two. It could be the devil actually had a second, double gang at raping her.
Right.
Or it could have been him telling her to harm herself, and she's having this fantasy where she's being raped and she's cutting herself up. So, but either way, I do believe it was the devil that did it. The question is whether he was physically there or not, or if it was a mental projection to make her do it. I believe it was Milton. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. I agree with Phil. And why that's so interesting is because I agree that it can be both things. I mean, the devil, right? There's that whole scene where he's paying attention to her and at the party when her husband has already gone down the rabbit hole of ignoring her and treating her like crap. And here's this guy who comes along and he's really kind to her. So he pays attention to her when her husband is all of a sudden not. And you know, my dad used to say this all the time, and I think he was right. My dad used to say men cheat because they just cheat. It's kind of the way they're built, and that's okay. It's just the way we're built. Women cheat because something is lacking. And he'd be like, in their marriage or their current relationship or their current whatever it is, something is lacking in their lives. And so they go looking for it elsewhere. And that's why I kind of agree with Phil that it was both things, because I think the devil, you know, we talk a lot in Christianity about the devil being the great tempter. You know, here he is plugging into this woman saying, I am giving you all of these things. You know, he's like a narcissist, kind of. He's like, I'm giving you all these things that you want. I'm telling you all these things you want to hear. And therefore, I can manipulate you into either harming yourself, or you're just fantasizing about me on a regular, non-supernatural level because you're starving for attention and love. And so I think it's really a metaphor for, like I said, I agree with Phil. I think it's actually both things. And I think it was brilliantly left open to interpretation for a reason. And all I'm going to say is if you listen to the director's commentary, he does comment on what he was actually trying to do. Okay. And I'm not going to reveal that here. Because he does kind of tell you the answer, but it's still not really an answer. So
I don't know that it fundamentally matters, right? Because we're pretty much seeing the majority of the film from Keanu Reeves' point of view. Something horrible happens to his wife. You know, if we put ourselves in his shoes, right? If Eric, if someone told you that they were raped by Billy Zane at the same time that you were doing the panel with him last Friday. I don't care if it's your best friend in the world. You would go, no. It's just like a Billy Zane impersonator or something. Mm-hmm. You know, he was right there next to me.
Right, right.
But in the end, whether it's because she's mad and mutilated herself and just, I mean, no one believes she was lying, right?
No.
Right.
She either did it or
she believes that happened.
Right. Okay. Whether it did or not. Okay. So that's the key, because whether it happened and he did it or
she's delusional.
It's still because of what Milton did.
Okay.
Right.
Right. And so Milton's responsible for her state one way or another.
Okay.
Right.
That's what I would say.
Then we get the reveal later on that he pulled thing with the mom.
I just want to say that he at least started the journey that she was on, because again, a lot of the journey could have ended had Keanu Reeves quit the job and paid more attention to his wife. You see what
this
I'm saying?
This was the wife who had pushed him into the job at the
Kind of switched thesis in the middle of that sentence.
Well, basically what Mike said was is that Milton was the cause, and I wanted to state that it was somewhat his the husband's fault too, because he at any moment when Al Pacino on the street when they're in Chinatown says you should quit this case and go back and help your wife until she's better. If he had done that,
right,
she wouldn't have gone the road that it finally turned out to, is what I meant.
Right, exactly.
But Mike is right, though. She's at fault as well, because she's the one that wanted that lifestyle in the first place. But go on, Christian, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, no, I was just saying it was kind of like what my dad said. You know, it's when women lack, they look for things. You know, because we as women, when we're raised, okay, we all look for the perfect guy. Okay, I don't think that guys so much look for the perfect women. I think that guys are kind of like, I have these fantasies when I'm younger, and oh, wow, but this girl's really awesome. I'm just going to go for her despite her imperfections. And I think they do accept them. But I truly believe that women are a little different. We are kind of raised to look for the perfect man. And when we don't find the perfect man, we go looking for that shit elsewhere.
Which they could have found if they listened to the Dark Discussions podcast.
There you go.
Fundamentally, instinctively, men are hunters, women are gatherers, women are shoppers, right? Men are just, they see a deer, they're like, oh, thank fucking God we found a deer.
Yep, exactly.
We don't care if it's 5 point, 3 point, buck, doe, whatever. Nail it, right? Take it down. Where women are like, oh, this one's nice, but I think there might be another one over there. You know, let me comparison shop. Let me see if there's a better bush of berries over that way, you know,
and that's why women love sales and coupons.
Right.
And like any woman who's going to give you shit about that is just talking at her asshole because she doesn't understand her own gender.
It's a broad spectrum. There's a lot of variability, but we're talking archetypes here, right? Middle of the bell curve male, middle of the bell curve female.
Right. And that is what this movie is essentially dealing with. It is not looking at the delicacies. It is looking at the base, right? And if you think about it, that's a really interesting thing because this movie also has a lot of biblical stuff in it, right? So what is the Bible? It's a base statement of things. And that's not a negative. It's just that's what it is. The Bible, and I'm sure many Christians would agree with me, or at least the smarter Christians, like the Kevin Letzes of the world, would agree with me. The Bible.
Oh my God! I hope he agrees with you now, because otherwise you just called him a dummy.
No. He knows that I don't think he's a dummy. He's an extremely smart guy. But I think Kevin Letz would agree with me that the Bible does try to polarize things, and it does try to make things simpler and easier. And Kevin Letz and I have had a lot of really awesome discussions offline about a lot of very intricate things in the Bible. I mean, Letz is an intelligent man, and he understands. But he also understands that the Bible is a book of rules, okay? And what do rules try to do? Rules try to boil things down into black and white, right? They try to make it simple. You know, do this, don't do that. The Bible is actually a lot more complicated than that. If you really invest the time in studying it. It's got a lot of levels. And what this movie tries to do is address those levels of rules. What is right? What is wrong? For example, that beautiful thing in the beginning, right? Where here's Keanu Reeves as Lomax. He is defending this guy who's the pervert. He is defending this guy with his entire soul. Right? He believes. Until all of a sudden, he figures out that guy's really a pervert. That guy really did it. Then he runs into the bathroom and he's like, holy shit. I took an oath to defend this man, whether he was right or wrong. And on the other side, he's got, I believe this guy was right. now I think he's wrong. Oh, holy shit. And here's where we get into the gray area of morality. Which side are you going to choose? Exactly. That's what I'm saying about the Bible. It's like it's all kind of gray like that when you really look at it. A lot of people take it as black and white, but it's actually not.
Well, so, and that's part of the great speech that Al Pacino gives at the end of this movie when he's going on his rant about look, but don't touch, right? Going on about the rules and all that. So I thought that was probably the best part of the movie is at the end when Al Pacino gets to go in full Pacino mode and give his rant from Satan's point of view.
Yeah, and that was a brilliant speech. Like, everything is kind of in a gray area. You know, and what are you really going to accept and what choice are you going to make and what it boils down to is choice. Like, many Christians today say or have said in the past, and Kevin Letts and I have often discussed this too, just in case you're wondering, if God is so wonderful, why does he allow the devil to exist? And that's because God also supposedly allows for free choice. He allows for free will. You can choose what you'd like. And that's where you kind of come into that gray area. And that's why I think this movie has so much to say about the choices we make every day. What's good? What's bad? What's a gray area? What's a black and white area? There is no black and white. There kind of really is.
Well, according to the film. A perfect example of the no black and white and this more gray area of the Bible is the prodigal son, where there's the two sons. The father gives each of them, you know, whatever, let's just say $10,000. The one son goes off, leaves the farm, and uses the money to party it up with whores and booze. And the other son uses it to buy more land and build the farm and whatnot. And then 10 years later, the prodigal son comes back and says, and he's like all screwed up, crappy clothes. He says, I lost all my money. I wasted it on whores and drugs and whatever. And the father says, wonderful. Let me make a great meal for you and welcome back. And the other son says, well, how can we do this? That's ridiculous. This guy, I mean, I've been living this great life, you know, worshiping God, helping you out, whatever. And the other son, my brother, basically partied up with whores and basically gave us the middle finger. And the father says it doesn't matter because he's back and he's in the fold again. And that's a perfect example of how the Bible is not just straight black and white, because it's trying to say that the one that effed up is still as good as the ones that don't eff up, especially when they come back to the flock. So, you know,
but he also assures the son he's kind of going to get his later. This is a celebration because it's not just like they're having a quick pizza party. They like kill the best calf and they like expend a lot of the other son's future fortune on the party celebrating the brother. But it's the phrase, you know, he was lost, but has been found. Right. Is that.
Right.
You know, they're celebrating his return. They're not just throwing him a party because he's a cool dude.
That's an excellent point. Right. And you know, if it was black and white, it would have just said that the prodigal son, he's damned and it doesn't matter that he's come back and is back with in the fold because it's too late. He already fucked up. And you know, that's black and white. But here, it's not black and white in this story, because the prodigal son's basically grayish, because you have a guy that fucked up, but he's back in the fold. And it doesn't matter that his life was all screwed up, and the other son was good the whole time. But again, it also could mean, like you said, Mike, too, that the other son is going to be promised more in the afterlife, you know, because he didn't fuck up in the first place. But
well, he's still going to inherit like his father's property and all the rest of it, if I remember the story correctly.
Yeah, that's a fair point, right?
So he will get his reward, and that is the, since we're talking something biblical, that's the metaphor that, you know, those who have led those who've led a good life will get your reward later, you know, but let us celebrate those who strayed and have come back to the path.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's the cool thing about that story. It's a metaphor, absolutely. Right. And a lot of the New Testament, especially the four Gospels, is stories that Jesus tell that are all basically metaphors. And they don't
right.
really happen. Yeah.
Yeah, and the devil's advocate, you know, it is, for my bitching about the legalistics earlier, it is a story, which is why it doesn't really bother me much, is that it is a parable, right?
Yes.
And we get the bailout at the end. But the story is a parable that, you know, is a caution against temptation, a caution against, you know, whatever, self-indulgence or you know, and giving in to the pretty things in front of us.
Yeah,
you know, narcissism. To those who would stroke our ego.
Right. Yeah, money, hot chicks, selfishness, all that stuff. It's a warning for all those things, basically. And it's also the what you had before wasn't all that bad. In other words, when you were in Gainesville, was your life really that bad? No, he was still a star.
Yeah, but I mean, most of us want recognition.
Yeah.
Right. Most of us want. You know, most people don't think they're doing a bad job,
mm-hmm.
Even though they may be terrible.
Right.
You think about the worst person you work with.
Yep.
There's a really good chance they're complaining about all the other fuck-ups at work who don't know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we never feel like, or very rarely do we feel like, that we're getting the acclaim that we are entitled to, whether we are or not. You know, so it's that's why pride is such a big thing. It's why temptation is such an easy thing. It's always easy to give us what we want. It's always easy to flatter us to some right. degree or another.
Right, right. Well, and you know, I mean, over this weekend at Scaricon, there was the podcast awards, and obviously they only chose, there were six categories, and they chose six winners and one also ran type of thing. So there were seven winners, basically. And when the people came up and got the awards, they were very, very excited and real happy. And that's part of, you know, recognition and being noticed and loved and whatever. But, you know, other podcasts like the Horror Mafia, I talked to Joey. He texted me after the weekend. He asked if he had won yet because he hadn't heard. And I told him, no, that you guys didn't win. And, you know, he was a bit disappointed, probably.
And then he rubbed out Crest.
Yeah, the Horror Mafia, they're going to rub him out. But no, on a serious note, I still, you know, no disrespect to any of the podcasts that won. I still love the Horror Mafia better than any of them that won. So, you know, so if my opinion means anything, you know, there it is. You know, that, you know, you guys are awesome. So it's like you said. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, even though he was somewhat of a star in Gainesville and was getting his ego stroked, it's nothing like, you know, as Frank Sinatra would sing, you know, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. So I guess it's more important or better for the ego or better for his narcissistic, you know, views or whatever to do it in New York. And again,
also, there's also a lot of money there. There's big famous cases there.
Right.
And, you know, they say money can't buy happiness, but man, it can sure make that misery a little bit easier sometimes, you know?
Absolutely.
You know, you don't have to worry about putting a roof over
your
head. Losing your house, clothes, food, medical insurance, and all the rest of it. There's all sorts of things. Now, there may be diminishing returns after a certain point, and you could debate when those diminishing returns occur. And certainly you can get blinded, therefore, by things, but we are material creatures. We do need material goods too.
Right, right. Well, and that's the question that I guess this film's asking us too. It's like how much. I mean, again, he's not hasn't worked in New York that long, so it's not like he could have accrued, you know, $1 million in the bank, and then even if he did get fired or be screw up, it wouldn't matter. At least financially, where he's, because he still would have a good life. But It is also one of the things is like how much money do you need before you don't need it anymore. I mean, Eric, you know from football, and Mike, you know from baseball, and Chrissy, I'm sure you know too for sports as well as just in Hollywood in general, mm-hmm. how people are making, you know, say they're making $5 million a year. Well, let me just use a baseball example. You know, Travis Harper was going to make over $100 million no matter where he went. The question is, did he want to make $100 million and go to a town that he's already loved in, or maybe a town closer to where his family and friends are, or did he just want to make the most money he could possibly make, period? Even though to someone like us, doesn't really matter if you're making $100 million or $250 million because it's just ridiculous money anyway. So,
but I think, and if you, from what I've picked up, and obviously everybody's an individual, yeah. But if you're a professional athlete, you are something different than the rest of us in your mindset, and a lot of times. And for a lot of these guys, it's not about the money; it's about how much the money the last guy got. They're very competitive. Yep. And so if you think you're the best in the game, you want the biggest contract. And if the last biggest contract was $350 million, you want $400 million. Not because you want $400 million, but because you want to be the biggest.
Right.
And that's a different type of temptation. It's still a temptation. It's not so much about the money. The money in some ways is irrelevant. You know, it's just the competitive nature, and that is its own form of pride. It's, you know, it's its own thing.
And it's just bizarre because, I mean, Eric, you know, Joey Garoppolo, you know, was the highest paid player for a period, and he hasn't done anything.
You mean Jimmy Garoppolo?
Whatever, yeah, Jimmy Garoppolo, I'm sorry. I should know that because he's originally a Patriot.
yes, you should.
Yeah, so, you know, Garoppolo was the highest paid player in the game over, you know, the greatest quarterbacks in the game, and everybody's like, you know, you scratch your head, you know, and yet, It's more of opportunity and timing rather than just being the greatest. So in other words, Travis Harper. Yeah, go on, Eric.
I think the point that Mike was trying to make is that it's not necessarily about you don't have enough money. It's about the ego stroking of, hey, look, the last guy got this much. I want more because that'll signify that I'm better.
Even though it's not in the case with like a guy like Jimmy Garoppolo who makes the most. I mean, obviously
we weren't looking for reality here.
There are guys who, you know, they'll get paid their fortune. They'll get paid their generational amounts of money, but they will take less to stay with the team that they want that they're having success with. You know, and I don't wish that the owners of baseball get to keep more money to put in their pocket, or football, or whatever it is. The players make them their money. I'd like to, you know, the players to get some more of that money. But I'm happy when I see a player have enough wisdom to recognize when they have a good thing, when they're happy in a place, and they're going to stay in that place rather than just chase their ego.
Right. And so is it the guy's name Lomax, is it? Lomax? What the heck's the character's name?
Lomax.
Lomax.
Yeah, Lomax. So did Lomax not have the wisdom and was driven by that ego?
Absolutely.
But you know what, though? Again, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the point
of the whole movie.
but there's also the wild card, right, which is that he's married and she's pushing him as well. So there's a lot of aspects. I mean, if he was single, again, it wouldn't matter as much as, say, that if he wasn't single, but if he was single, he wouldn't have the person telling him, let's go for it, because she wanted it even more than he did at the beginning.
Well, I think that's negligible, because if he's single, then why wouldn't he go?
Well, that's my point. It's like that he wasn't necessarily gonna, if she had said, well, we did our job in New York, you picked the jury, let's head back home, I think he would have went back home. But again, would he hold it against his wife and say, you ruined my potential? Or, but you know what, again, he's the type of character
that's another thing that's interesting about this movie, is that he's the type of character that I don't think would have held it against his wife. It was more because he wasn't really that big of a narcissist. His narcissism, to me, felt no more than just a normal person's narcissism. It wasn't like the guys from Wolf of Wall Street or Wall Street.
Oh, yes. I would agree. I do not believe that Keanu Reeves as a character, Lomax, was actually a narcissist. I believe that he truly was just seduced. Like, he wanted better, and like I said, he just kind of spindled out of control. He got worse and worse and worse. He got sucked in, you know?
Right.
Well, but at the same time, I mean, I think there is that sort of, with the athletes, there is a competitiveness to him. He had a chance in that, if I remember correctly, in that opening scene, he had a chance to throw that trial. He had a chance to not go after the girl on the stand. But he didn't want to lose. He didn't want to break his perfect streak. And he has a guy that he doesn't know is guilty, but now he suspects is guilty. And he could have pushed him under the bus, and so he goes after the girl, goes straight for a jugular, and she you could argue whether she deserves it or not, because she was victimized. But he had an opportunity there. That was part of the idea of this, him being scouted, right, by Milton's headhunter. You know, is that he was watching him and he saw him go for the kill when he didn't have to do it.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Also, another point that helped, that showed that he was somewhat narcissistic, was that, okay, he was in a smaller town, his wife was hot shit, and he knew it, and she knew it, and pleasing her was part of, I guess, his narcissism. So in other words, going to New York, doing what she asked, taking the job, rubbing elbows with these famous people and important people, movers and shakers and whatnot. Part of that, the reason he did that in the first place, was because he wanted to please her rather than, I think, his own personal pleasure. And by pleasing, because in other words, if you have an attractive spouse, you don't want to lose that attractive spouse, and you want to give as much to that spouse as much as you can. So that's what he was doing. And so it doesn't matter that she's attractive, but I mean, in this case, she was a hot shit. So I think that was part of the thing too, is that his narcissism to take that girl down on the stand and to go to New York were all coming from the same ego that he has, which is make my wife happy makes me happy, take down this woman makes my wife happy, as well as makes me happy because people adore me and my wife adores me and the crowd adores me and whatever. So I think the wife in the movie is an interesting wild card that we see in this film compared to these other films that we've used. And we've seen it in The Firm where the wife is all into it too. And he actually does screw up and he does cheat on her and screws up his entire marriage. And that's when he wakes up. While here, he never does that. What he does that's wrong is when she starts breaking down, he doesn't know how to deal with mental illness. He just gets pissed. I don't know. I mean, there's just some interesting things about the film that I thought about the whole scenario compared to the usual Faustian story, I guess.
Well, even with his doing the jury selection, you know, he's walking in, you know, from the little podunk town in Florida into Manhattan, into, one of the top lawyers at one of the top firms in the country, and telling him how to do his job. Right. And he basically takes his dick out and says, mine's bigger.
Yeah, he's cocky when he's choosing the jury. Absolutely.
Yeah. So he doesn't do, which, you know, he's not exactly, you know, fresh out of law school. But he shows absolutely no deference.
He's not humble. He's not showing respect.
There is no humility. Now, you're not supposed to have false humility either. Yep. You know, but you're also not supposed to have pride. It's a really weird line you have to walk. But yeah, he's definitely, I mean, he starts with pride, and that's part of Milton's speech when he talks about how pride is his right. Pride is his favorite of the sins.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, we've seen in Seven with the seven deadly sins, and pride is one of the big ones. She cuts her nose. He cuts her nose to, I forget, what is it?
Spider face?
Cuts off the nose to spite the face is the phrase you're looking for, yeah.
Exactly.
But on another track, since you've been talking about morality and stuff for a while, I would like to mention a couple of things in this movie that are done kind of symbolically that are really neat. There are some interesting things done in this film with color. The bathroom, for example, that Lomax enters in the opening scene is all in shades of gray. And in fact, if you look at everyone in the courtroom, they're all dressed in shades of gray as well. In fact, it's almost like a sea of gray. If you could just kind of stand back and just look at it, like without focusing your eyes on any one thing. And this kind of suggests that Lomax originally, getting back to all the stuff we were just talking about, lives his life in a gray area, that there is no moral outright correct and wrong for him, that he can't make peace with his conscience. And you know, like I said earlier, he discovers to his horror that his client's fingering under the table, the guy is completely guilty. But he's able to justify it because he doesn't want to ruin that perfect record. So he's going to end up defending this loser because that's what he's paid to do. But also, in that scene, we're presented with a dilemma right off the bat that he doesn't want to ruin that record. But then, when he gets to New York City, notice how much color that is. Did you guys notice that?
No, but I can see it as I'm remembering the film.
Yeah, when we arrive in New York City, we start actually seeing splashes of color. You know, the whole business with the pink colors on the walls.
And Chrissy, don't forget the color of the walls, and she is influenced and changes it, and he's like shocked.
Exactly. And then he goes to the party, and the women are, this is the director that actually said this on the commentary, I deliberately made all the beautiful women he meets look like birds of paradise. And that's what they're referred to in the script.
Birds of paradise, what's that mean?
A bird of paradise is a tropical flower is very beautiful. I mean, it's not like rainbow colored or anything like that. But if you Google bird of paradise,
it's a lot of orange in it, I see.
Yeah, it's a lot of orange. Yep. It's a lot of bright and beautiful color. And right. It's referred to.
And Connie Nielsen is a redhead in the film, so that makes sense.
Yes, correct. And she's all in red. And the director in his commentary actually said, I did that on purpose. Right. That all of the other women, except for Lomax's wife, I created them like birds of paradise. Like they're all beautiful. They're all exotic, right? They're all like a contrast, to whatever background they're set against to create that temptation. And there's also a lot of subtlety about like the song that they play in the opening of the film, Show Me Your Tattoos. You know, and those lyrics, or at least that line and the title of that song.
That's the one in the bar, right?
Yeah, it's the one in the bar. They metaphorically suggest that Lomax and his wife are about to see the dirty secrets of the world, the dark sides of themselves and of the world. I just kind of wanted to take a break from the morality discussion and sort of get into that because there's a lot of brilliant stuff that's done in this film that all kind of subtly undercurrents and supports this. But anyway, I just wanted to bring that
up. So if I remember correctly, if I can go back to the color for a second, there's that montage of her trying to find the right color green for the walls.
Yeah.
And when they're criticizing the how horrible her color choices of green are, aren't the women wearing those shades of green on their dresses?
Yes, they are. And I believe that that particular comment, if I had to guess, ties into the idea of she wants to be like them, but she doesn't. And green is a symbol of jealousy, but it's also a symbol of greed. It
and
is
then,
the color
and
of greed,
then,
but it's also the color of jealousy, which is also makes it very interesting. Symbolically.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, and I thought that the women, the wives of the other lawyers, were also another tool used to kind of send the wife over the edge.
Oh, they're gaslighting her.
Yeah, they're basically like, look, honey, this is the life now. Your husband is married to the job, so you just take his money and have fun.
Yeah.
Mike, explain what gaslighting is.
Gaslighting comes from an old play in which
it's. It comes from the movie Gaslight. I know that. Which
I think
Ingrid
it started.
I think it started as a
stage show, but yeah, it's in which the husband tries to convince his wife she's going mad by playing around with the gas lights in their house, and you know he claims he's to not notice anything, and she thinks she's going nuts because the lights keep going up and down, and she doesn't know what's going on. So in this case, right, so you have. You know, one of the attractive women wearing a specific shade of green, and she gets a was it wallpaper or paint?
Yeah,
paint.
Paint. Yes, yeah.
Paint.
It was kind of both, though. It was kind of both because she was also picking out wallpapers at one point.
Right, and but it doesn't matter. It's green.
No, but she gets the paint or wallpaper that exactly matches the dress she's wearing, and she says, "Oh my God, that's a hideous color. Why would you ever do that?" You know, and it's kind of gaslighting her in that way. It's like, but you're wearing that color,
mm-hmm.
you know, and but you know, oh my God, I hate that. Looks terrible. And so it's them kind of just pushing her, you know, into a little further into the madness by sewing her full of doubt.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's exactly in the modern context of gaslighting, Phil. If you are dating a narcissist, whether you're male or female, that is what they do. In other words, you will say to the person that you are with or, you know, whoever, or even a friend, toxic friends will do this to you too. I said that we were going to meet at the park at 7. And the narcissist will turn around and say, oh no, you said 6:30. And this is how I know you said 6:30. And they will fill your head with all of this crap and eventually make you doubt yourself. So
yeah,
that hey, I really did. I know what's what. And that's why it's interesting, Phil, that you were talking about narcissism earlier, because I think narcissism also plays a role in this film.
Oh, absolutely.
Particularly in the modern context, because narcissism is not just thinking you're wonderful and you're the best thing ever and I'm the greatest thing ever. Narcissism is actually a personality disorder where they are so fucked up. And I'm sorry, I have no sympathy for them. I have dated 3 of them in my life before I found Nathan, thank God, who's normal. But narcissists are screwed up. And they will completely convince you that what you see is not what's real. And what you believe is not valid. That is their whole game. And that also ties into this whole film about the comments on the devil, right? Because the devil lures you with pretty things and says, here it is. This is pretty. This is what you should want. And then you go for it. And of course, it's got a dark side, which ties all the way into Faust. You know, I will give you whatever you want, but then I take your soul. It's the same thing. And that's why today's narcissistic personality disorder is frequently compared to this kind of thing, because it is like dealing with the devil. You just don't know what the hell you're going to get.
They've been almost hand in hand now with sociopaths, to be honest, and are thrown in with that group of mental disorders or
oh, as well they
disorders.
Should be.
Yeah,
they should be. They are true sickos. There is no way around that. I've been there. I've seen. I've dated a few. I've seen other women that have been with them, and they really are like
my friends. Never mind, friends.
My God, friends are actually worse.
Phil,
yeah.
I just saw a great example of gaslighting in some popular art. I've been watching The Good Wife on Amazon.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a several episode arc in which Matthew Perry of Friends fame shows up as this guy, and he just flat out he goes on TV and during a press conference says that the main character invited her to her office and asked him to change a report when we actually saw what happened, which is that he showed up at her office unannounced and offered her to submit a modification. So she shows up at his office and goes, "Why did you lie?" And he goes, I didn't lie. And she goes, "No, you lied. You said I invited you to my office. I did not invite you to my office." He's like, "Oh, yeah, of course you did. Why else would I show up?" And gaslighting is just insisting that what's not the truth is actually the truth. And it often causes the other person to doubt their own sanity.
Right, and that's exactly what happens to Charlize Theron. I mean, maybe if she was a stronger person or knew the New York, or let me rephrase that, the big city ways,
mm-hmm.
She wouldn't have fallen for it. But again, maybe her psyche was always one of those type of folks who, in Gainesville, it would never have broke. But in... Mm-hmm. A different environment like New York, it would.
I honestly think that all of this can be blamed on the mom. Because if she had spoken up sooner about knowing John Milton and exactly what his involvement was, maybe the wife would still be alive. Yeah.
Well, that was an awesome aspect of this film, too, is that the mother hates the daughter-in-law when they're mm-hmm. in Gainesville, but when they get to New York City and she starts seeing the daughter-in-law crumble, she actually begins to like the daughter-in-law. And mm-hmm. I like how that is. However, she was a weak person too, like the wife, because rather than staying and helping the wife, because she could have, she was scared and ran, and she went back to Gainesville. But again, you know, when people are in certain situations, we really don't have a right to judge them, I guess. But it was an interesting thing where before we find out that he was the devil and that she, meaning the mother, had a one-night stand with him, when she ran and left the daughter-in-law to go further down the rabbit hole, I was pissed. But looking back now, I could see she was as scared as the daughter-in-law.
Yeah, yeah.
What else? Anything else anybody wanted to bring up? Any other scenes or anything of note? In other words, any other big points in the film or discussion points anybody had that we haven't hit yet? Nice. That's pretty interesting.
Well, I mean, we kind of glossed over the climax.
I do want to say something about the magical portion too, about the Papa Lugwa scene where he's first invited in. But let Eric talk first, and then I'll go back to that.
Well, it's kind of unrelated. No, let's go to the climax last. You go ahead, Chrissy. We'll go to the climax last.
Oh, okay. All right. Give me one second. Okay. Eric, just talk, and I'll come back.
What's going on?
She's walking away from her Bluetooth. Far away from the computer. All right, so she'll come back and discuss that in a moment. But she obviously has to get her notes. But basically,
we just never talked about the actual climax, which is that Al Pacino reveals that he's the devil, and that Keanu Reeves is his son. And that Connie Nielsen is his half-sister, I guess?
Yes.
And then once the two of them have a child together to create the Antichrist.
Yeah, basically, Connie Nielsen was the female version of Keanu Reeves' character.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike Keanu Reeves, she had already been tempted and had joined
Yes.
Basically. So,
well,
yeah, go on.
Well, shit, if they want him to have sex with his sister, he could have just stayed in Florida.
Ba-dum-bum. So in other words, it could have been a whole other movie that showed Connie Nielsen's storyline and how mm-hmm. she actually lost, or I mean, in her eyes, she didn't lose, but based off of what we know of being tempted by the devil, she had lost, and that's basically what his story, meaning Keanu Reeves' story, was to have him. "Quote unquote lose too," and then if he had lost, he and Connie Nielsen's character would have gotten together, and like you said, created the Antichrist. Yeah.
So we get to the point where this is all going on, and it looks like he's gonna join, and he's gonna do it, but then at the last second, because he has free will, he grabs a gun and offs himself. Much to the dismay of the devil, who throws pitches a fit. I think that's an accurate description. Pitches a fit.
One of the interesting aspects was Connie Nielsen's character, who at this point is in her birthday suit. But the thing that was more interesting than that is the fact that she does the cross. She does the pose of the cross when she kind of. Mm-hmm. Is trying to give herself to tempt Keanu Reeves, I guess.
Right.
And I thought that was interesting. I mean, a lot of films do that anyway, where they just have the pose of the cross in some arbitrary scene. And here, whether or not it was just to add another biblical
reference.
Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. I don't know. I'm not really quite sure. Chris, are you back yet?
Yep, I'm back.
Okay. Before we get into what you wanted to talk about, what did you think of that? The Christ pose of the nude Connie Nielsen and why they did that, except for maybe just a biblical reference. Or maybe you don't have any thoughts at all.
I actually don't have any thoughts on that particular image, because to me that was pretty obvious.
Right. It was in your face.
It was
right?
In your face, and there is right, and that's okay. There was a lot of really wonderful iconography in this film, and iconography meaning like, you know, biblical symbolism, biblical art, stuff like that. And so I kind of looked at that as a weaving into it. There's almost a medieval woodcut kind of flavor to a lot of the art you see in this. It's very heavy in that way. The director does talk about this in the commentary, that they really packed the sets in this film. They even used frescoes from Thai and Cambodian temples and places, which is kind of an interesting, you know, blend. There were also a lot of religious organizations that helped him. So when she offered herself as a Christ figure to him, if you kind of look at what's going on in terms of the artwork around them, like in the scene behind them, like that's the point where the statue's moving. And, you know, you have the golden pillars. And there's places in this movie where you see many golden pillars together. It's almost altar-like. So I almost wanted to kind of think of that as it's a bastardization. You know, she's sort of offering herself as, here I am, fuck me, right? Even though I'm technically your sister. But if you look behind her hands, there's a gold pillar on either side. So she's throwing herself on the sacrificial altar, which is sort of like a bastardization of, you know, not, I'm not saying this in moral judgment, I'm just saying this symbolically, a bastardization of what Christianity holds dear, right? You have the virgin, and yet she is not a virgin. And she is throwing herself on the altar as not a virgin to her brother, which is incest. So to me, that image was almost the ultimate in the depraved choice. The choice you shouldn't make. Does that am I making any sense at all?
Yep.
Like,
yeah, it's lading the profane over the divine.
Profane over that, right. And he did a lot with that. And one of the places that the director did a lot of that was there was some very interesting stuff going on in that scene where he goes underground, you know, on his first mission where he has to go meet Moyes or whatever his name is. And there's a statue there of Papa Lugba. And then when you look again, it's actually a person, and that becomes Moyes. Now, I watched it with Nathan. This is one of Nathan's favorite movies. And Nathan wasn't sure if it was voodoo or Santeria, but traditionally in voodoo, you know, nails, especially coffin nails, they're used in spells, and the cow's tongue was also used, which is, you know, he was twisting the cow's tongue. And basically the spell that he was doing was he was nailing the prosecuting attorney's mouth shut, right? And we did get to see that. And then Santeria is very different from voodoo. And there was this whole thing about the stone penis because it has to do with Alegua. And Alegua's symbol is the genitalia. And there's this – and but Alegua is the god of doorways and Papa Lugua is the god of the crossroads. And there's all this stuff. Well, if you listen to the rector's commentary, this goes back to what I was saying about her sacrificing herself as a virgin. It turns out that the director for this film was deliberately, in that particular scene, not referencing – he was referencing Santeria. He was referencing voodoo. He was referencing African religions, but he was deliberately keeping it vague. Because he felt like if he then at the end showed this woman as a profane, you know, in this big profane moment, as you referenced, Mike, if he favored one religion over another, that particular moment was not going to have the kind of message that he wanted to send.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Does it? Or am
I
talking crazy?
I mean, well, doesn't have to be either.
I'm not hearing anything from Mike and Eric.
Well, you know what? The whole thing about that first mini trial that he had about the religious ceremony and sacrificing animals and all that versus just killing an animal in the city non-religiously and being quote unquote unclean in a sense, or you know, with the health department, it makes a lot of sense. And it was a good analogy because even today, it's even more important even today because with all the multiple religions in New York City specifically, never mind throughout the country, in big cities, a lot of folks do these things that maybe years ago we would look at and go, you know, crack down on. Nowadays, they wouldn't crack down at all. So when I rewatched this film 22 years later and I saw this scene, I almost laughed because something like that wouldn't even go to trial nowadays because it's like, oh, it's just a religious ceremony. There's no way a district attorney or even the police would probably, you know, pursue something like that because of the political correctness that we live in today. But, you know, 22 years ago, that was an excellent example of something that would be considered controversial in a sense. Though this isn't directly related to what you were saying, Chrissy, it's at least related to the scene itself and how I was looking at it. So I just wanted to bring that up. Anything else, Chrissy? Was that the main point that you wanted to bring up earlier, or was there some other stuff too?
That was really the only comment I wanted to make was just about that scene because it did. I think it's a pivotal opposite to the end.
Right.
But also the director. Did you guys know how he made that statue? Did you guys listen to the commentary?
I did not.
The way that they did that, and I guess this was. It was practically done, and then they merged it with CGI, was they took people and they put them in a swimming pool. They hired ballet dancers.
Oh, that's right. I did hear that.
Yeah, and they put them in a swimming pool. And that's why that statue was so gorgeous.
Yeah.
And then he said I don't remember if he said they did CGI. I don't know. It was 94. So this would have been right. Or 97. So this would have only been like 4 years after Jurassic Park. And so the big moves in CGI were just starting to happen.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But I'm interested because, Phil, you said that you and Eric had like a different version where they didn't cut some of that statue out.
Right.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah.
I haven't seen the one you have, so I can't.
but we'll tell you what we saw. What it is that the statue comes alive and there's all these hot, naked people, both male and female, moving around. And like you said, it was done through the pool, which I do remember listening to that commentary back in 96, I think, when I watched it with the commentary. And so it made it a very erotic and part of the temptation of how sex can bring people down the wrong road, in a sense. And what happened was is that the artist who made the real statue, the one that they actually used, and then they made that CGI scene, and the water, the underwater scene, based on top of this statue. That's when the artist got pissed because he felt it was, I guess, insulting to the work, but it also he may have been offended because of the sexuality to it or something. And so what happened was is that they tried to cut out most of that. So I'm even surprised that you saw a part of that in your copy, Chrissy, because I thought the new copy or the copy that is readily available that's not now $100 on Amazon and eBay was the one where they just literally just cut it out and you just see the statue in the background without the people doing the sexual orgy that me and Eric seen in our copy. What did you see in your copy? Exactly, Chrissy.
When you see the statue moving, you see all the things behind them. But even I remembered in 1997, it seemed like it was more explosive and it was more beautiful. There was a lot more nudity. It was much more focused on it. It was much more horrifying, too. I remember when the statue burst to life, I was like, oh, my God. You know,
yeah,
it was
kind of
scary.
It was kind of a combination. It was kind of a combination of an orgy and also like those Italian and French paintings of hell where all the naked bodies are being tortured by, the demons.
Right. And in my copy of the film that I have, you see it come to life. It seems like that part is cut. There is not a whole lot of orgy-ish that you see. It pretty much just fades to the background. And my housemate Charles said to me, too, he's on a forum with a lot of film experts and a lot of film restoration experts, and they have long been crying about the fact that the original theatrical presentation is not available. Because even, I guess, the version that you guys have, Phil, is not what it originally was. Which, I don't remember. It was almost 30 years ago. Like, I don't, 22 years ago. I don't remember what I saw in the theater. But I do remember, after not having seen it for 22 years and then putting it in, watching it here, I was like, wait, I thought there was a bigger deal about this statue. And it just seemed like it went on longer. And we actually got a view of mm-hmm. some things that were very lascivious and all of that. And on the DVD that I have, you barely see it.
Well, according to
to the background.
According to Wikipedia here, it says, after a federal judge ruled that the film's video release would be delayed until the case went to trial unless a settlement was reached, Warner Brothers agreed to edit the scene for future releases and to attach stickers to unedited videotapes to indicate there was no relation between the art in the film and Hart's work. The settlement in February 1998 meant 475,000 copies of the VHS and DVD could go into rental stores and businesses. That still leaves it unclear for me. So I guess some of them got out without being completely edited and just with a sticker put on the box.
Right. Interesting. Now, Eric, was I pretty close to? I mean, that's what you remember having just rewatched your version of the disc, right?
It was like it was a long time ago. So, I mean, my DVD in my memory isn't different than what I saw in the theater, but it was 1997. So,
right, yeah. But your DVD, it's pretty blatant, right? It's not like,
I mean, there's a whole scene with the statue moving around. Yeah,
very well. All right, so anything else, anyone?
I'm good.
All right,
yeah, I think I'm good too, if you guys are good.
Mike?
Yeah, I'm fine.
All right, either way, we'll just finish up with a couple of house cleaning. So first off, Eric, you do another podcast for everybody, yeah?
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Skancity Podcast. That's spelled Skancity. You can find it on Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes, and Spotify.
Excellent. And Mike, you do a blog and a couple other, or actually we don't do any other podcasts right now.
Right. No more podcasts. The blog is Unnatural Selections, www.unnaturalselections.com. The other podcasts are currently on hiatus, Searching for American Gods. Just finished its second season, which we're waiting for the third season to begin sometime in the future. Bullets and Brothels and Boss also is in the middle of its between its second and third season.
And that's Westworld.
About the HBO series Westworld. And we just wrapped up for good Jon Snow. You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a podcast about Game of Thrones, which if you want to go back and listen to that, we covered, what was it, the seasons 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8?
And 8, yeah.
Did we start in season 4 or did we start in season 5?
I think it was 4. We started with the Purple Wedding season, I think. And that's season 4, yeah. I'm pretty sure. But you're right, it could have been 5. I'd have to look back. But either way, we did two episodes on the Dark Discussions podcast doing all the other seasons that we hadn't done as individual episodes for You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, Game of Thrones podcast. Two things before we get to Chrissy. First off, Eric stated at Scaricon, and this is a quote, he may possibly do the spinoff of Game of Thrones in a year or two whenever it comes out, because you never know.
He was weak. That wasn't exactly what I said.
He had just interviewed the girls from the girls from Nightmare on Elm Street. I mean, he didn't know what he was saying.
I said, I definitely don't want to do it right now. Maybe I'll be over it a couple years from now. That's my actual quote.
Yes. So Sean Fox, there's a possibility that Eric will rejoin.
So you're saying there's a chance.
What was that from? What movie was that from?
Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was awesome. Also, Mike, me, you, and Eric are going to do a monthly spinoff. Well, not really a spinoff podcast, but a monthly movie podcast that is lesser than regular genre. So it could be stuff like westerns, dramas, some comedies, whatnot. That we
Die Hard.
Die Hard. But Mike, you came up with a title, and I think we're going to go with it.
Oh, good. It was Cinema a la Carte.
Cinema a la Carte podcast, which would be a monthly podcast, probably starting up in July. What's that, Eric?
I said it's going to be a monthly podcast about some movie, any movie that we decide to cover. That doesn't necessarily have to be genre.
We would probably not be covering on the regular Dark Discussions podcast.
Right.
And the title came to me because I was trying to think of something. I don't know why I was thinking about it on the drive home from Scaricon, which was about a 3-hour drive. And, you know, I thought about, well, we would just be sort of picking and choosing. And as someone of a Catholic upbringing, you may have heard the phrase cafeteria Catholic.
Yes.
Where you just pick and choose. what you want. And I thought cafeteria cinema sounded kind of cheesy. And so, well, what was that? What I was trying to remember, what's the other, like you know, and I was like, oh, it's a la carte, right? So I thought cinema a la carte kind of sounded silly and French and pretentious too. So
there you go. So that was good.
Right. So where Dark Discussions has themes, cinema a la carte has a theme of whatever the fuck we want.
Right. So like, like a film like Die Hard, which is a genre film, for example, would probably not be a type of film we would do on Dark Discussions. So this podcast would allow us to talk about some of these other type of films that
we really enjoy and we'd like to talk about. But and this all started with Phil and I bumping heads last year about what was
Mission Impossible,
appropriate for Dark Discussions. Mission Impossible was definitely part of the discussion. And I was just like, that's not like a Dark Discussion movie. And
but I said it was like, very dark because the whole world almost blew up.
And so after we went back and forth for a while, eventually the idea came up about, hey, why don't we do another podcast like once every 2 weeks or a month or whatever, where we can cover this other stuff and not dilute the Dark Discussions brand. So that was the intention. And it just took us a year to come up with a goddamn name for the thing.
And plus, we didn't want to start it when we were doing some of the spinoff podcasts, like You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, and stuff. So,
yeah, it's going to be a while before we get to the other podcasts again.
Yeah. So this gives us time to do one a month without headbutting the spinoff Dark Discussions podcast, like You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, and so forth.
Yep. Right. I'm looking forward to it. How about you guys?
Yeah,
I'm curious. I definitely don't want to be doing two podcasts a week again, because that would be insane, Eric.
Yeah, you'd have to be crazy.
Right, which is what Eric does now. Actually, Eric's been doing that for 11 years.
Yeah.
Well, pretty close to it. 8 years, actually. I'm sorry.
It's 2011.
Yeah, 2011. So
no, there's 11 years in there somewhere.
Yeah, so Eric's been doing two podcasts a year for 8 years.
And three sometimes.
And three sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
Two podcasts a week and three sometimes, yeah. So, very well. All right, so that's good. And now to Chrissy, who's actually has something even more exciting than any of that. She has a new book out. Chrissy?
She fell asleep.
Chrissy?
She fell asleep while we were gone on about her new podcast.
No. I think I turned you off when I meant to turn you on because that's the way it's supposed to work.
That's what she said.
Ooh, let's look on that. That's what she said. Yeah.
That is literally what she said.
I do. I have a new book out.
Chrissy,
yes.
There was one other time I didn't want to interrupt you, but you said something about he was plugged into her, and I almost screamed out, "That's what she said!" But I didn't want to interrupt you. So I'll say it now. That's what she said. That's awesome.
That's what she said. Yes, I have a new book out. It's called The Shadows Behind. It is dark short stories. I'm really excited about it. So thanks for the plug, Phil. You can find it on Amazon.com. You can order it from just about any bookstore that you normally frequent, especially local bookstores. Make sure you give them the business. And or if you'd like, you can reach out to me through any of the normal channels, my website, my Facebook. There's a link on Dark Discussions, I think, on the front page that goes somewhere. I don't know. But anyway, so that's it. You can find out more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com.
A couple of things related to that. The first one is whether you bring them or I get them from Amazon and bring them. I'll be seeing Chrissy along with Mike and Abe and Eric and Leo from The Dorking and a bunch of other people, including, I think, Holly Masiak and her family, and most certainly Kevin Letts, down in Mystic, Connecticut, where Dark Discussions will be there 26th, 27th, and 28th of July?
For the social event of the year.
It will be. Do not miss it, folks. Do not miss it.
And so down there, when I'm in person with Chrissy, we will get autographed copies and we will raffle them off on the podcast. So that'll be exciting. And the other exciting thing about the book is there's a big signing in a cavern. And when is this cavern and where is it?
Okay, I will be signing books on Saturday, August 3rd at Howe Caverns in upstate New York. Howe Caverns is located in Howe's Cave, New York. It is in Schoharie County. It is very close to Cooperstown. So if anybody out there is a baseball fan and would like to see, you know, the baseball museum and all of that, it is right near there. It is a natural cave. It was first explored in the middle to late 1800s. And it's a really awesome place to be. And it's beautiful, especially in the middle of the summer. I would not recommend this in winter unless you're a snow hound. But in the summer and the spring and fall, it's a lovely place to be. So I will be there from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Saturday, August 3rd. You can come and meet me and get a book. You can eat some of their spectacular homemade fudge that is made right on premises by their cheese, which is actually aged in the cave and really is pretty unique and very tasty. So there you go. That's all I got to say. And come take a cave tour and ride on their underground lake in the dark, which is also really cool.
Two questions, Chrissy. One is, and you can answer them together. One is, do they do mushrooms down in the cavern? And the second is, will you be signing actually in the cavern or upstairs in the gift shop?
I will be signing upstairs in the gift shop. The cave is a natural treasure, and so it is very limited in terms of what you can actually bring down in there, because certain metals and things can work over time to destroy cave formations. So I will be up top, but
that's
you can,
said.
Yeah. I will be. No, I didn't say I will be on top. Although if you'd like me to be on top, I can do that. Let's just put our imaginations to work. But yeah, so I will be up top. I will be in the floor, on the floor where there is the gift shop and the, you know, the cafe and all of that. Because to bring a lot of material down in the cave actually can work, like I said, over time, just like, you know, there's certain formations down there you cannot touch because human oil can actually erode the formation. So they're very careful about what they bring down there. So that's why I'm going to be up top and not actually in the cave. But anyway.
And mushrooms? None? Do they have them down there?
No, they don't. Actually, what's really interesting about Howe Caverns is they don't even have any wildlife down there. There are no blind cavefish. There's no frogs, you know, the blind frogs that you always hear about in certain caves. There's nothing down there. It is literally almost devoid of life except for bats.
All right, very good.
Fiction writers.
Yes, dark fiction writers, exactly.
Right, no, because there was double things that happened with mushrooms. One, I was watching reruns of Mr. Rogers with my kids on YouTube, and one of them was about mushrooms in Pennsylvania and in the caverns and how they grow them. And then, two, coming back from Skiers IKEA last year, I stopped at a Pennsylvania tourist info, and they I guess they have a huge mushroom festival in Pennsylvania, and not that New York is Pennsylvania. Caverns kind of made me think, oh, maybe they have mushrooms there. So just curious. All right. Thank you, Chrissy. And so hopefully people will come and see you at the caverns. Now, let's give our final thoughts on the film. So let's start with you, Eric.
This is a personal fave. I really like The Devil's Advocate. It's showing a little bit of age at this point, but I think it still holds up pretty well. And I really hope at some point they do some kind of Blu-ray restoration for it, because I would love to have a copy with better visual quality.
All right, very good. Chrissy?
I think this is a great film. I think everyone should see it. Keanu Reeves, this is early in his career, or earlier in his career. And this is, in my opinion, where he really starts to show his acting ability, which I think he always had, but it was kind of snuffed in various different projects that he chose. I think there are a lot of levels in this film. I think if you like to think, and I think if you like to look for stuff, you can certainly find it. On the other hand, if you just want to have a good time, you can definitely do that too. And also have a little fun while you're watching it, because the director on the commentary also pointed out that he made very specific allusions to films like The Omen, Rosemary's Baby, The Exorcist, and all of the other devil films that came before this. And those things are definitely in there. I did not get a chance to mention those or point them out tonight. So the fun is in looking for them. So that's my recommendations. Definitely see this.
All right. Very good. Yeah, I actually have a sweet spot for the film as well, because it was a film that I saw at theaters. It was when I was getting back into horror films, only a couple of years after Scream. So this was the film rejuvenating into horror, and getting back to it. So along with Scream and this film and a few others, it really, it means a lot to me just for that fact, because it had been a genre that I had kind of stopped watching prior to it. The story is a legendary story, you know, because of the Faust and all that. I mean, it's been around for hundreds of years, so it always is interesting to see it. I felt they did it differently because, again, rather than having the Wall Street or the Wolf of Wall Street type of individuals, it was fairly good people rather than people that were just despicable in the first place. And so seeing how it turns out was pretty cool and much different than you would usually think of for a Faustian story. And if you like horror, it has its blood and boobs. I mean, there's a lot of it in this, so it stands out specifically for that as well. So it has pretty much everything that a horror fan would like, and I recommend. And Connie Nielsen is unbelievable. Mike.
Yeah, I have a soft spot for the film because this is, I saw it in theaters and I loved it then. But it also one of the first films that my wife and I kind of bonded over. So I have affection for it for that reason, too. It is a little bit of a time capsule film in a way. It is from an era. It's easy to forget the 90s. While it's not known necessarily for great horror films, it does have some, but it's also an era of prestige horror, things like Bram Stoker's Dracula and Silence of the Lambs. And this is one of them where you would get big names in a horror film before they decided to go all low budget on us in the 2000s. And so it's kind of, while I think Eric is right, is that it's showing its age, I think that adds a little bit of an appeal in a different way for maybe at least people of our age, you know, to look back and go, you know, I remember when Al Pacino looked old in this movie, and now he looks kind of young in the movie. It's just a weird thing. There's a little bit of nostalgia to it now. I strongly recommend the film. It is definitely a fun film, especially if you like, you know, your satanic courtroom dramas. This is going to do it as well as any. And the actors chewing the scenery, some great visuals in it. The CGI is a little dated, but it's a blast. Give it a spin. You can rent it, I think, in most places digitally. I think I own a digital copy on Vudu. I think is how I watched it.
Yeah, and that's interesting that you brought that up, Mike. That's one thing we didn't mention. A courtroom drama at that time in Hollywood, courtroom dramas were huge. I mean, the year before was Primal Fear. We did an episode on that here on Dark Discussions. So there was a lot of films back in those days that were really, really into that. And then that's the thing that's interesting about this. I mean, Philadelphia was another one, 1993. But the thing that's interesting about this film is it took a genre that just had a rebirth
which was horror because of Scream from 1996, and a genre that was at the top of its peak, which was the courtroom drama, and it combined them, and that was kind of interesting. So it is a product of its time in that way, too, which is kind of funny. So that's Devil's Advocate, 1997, 22 years ago. All of us were able to see it at the theaters, or could have. Our co-host, Abe, who didn't make it tonight, obviously would have not, because he would have been a baby, literally a baby. That's how sad it is to think of how long ago this film was. But all in all, it appears that everybody liked it a whole lot. It was a great pick by Holly Masiak. Hopefully we did it justice and did an episode that was worthy of what she was hoping, since it was a Patreon pick, which we thank her very much, as well as all our other Patreon supporters for helping us out, and this is one way that we pay it back. So with all that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right, thanks for tuning in and listening to us talk about The Devil's Advocate. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.
You should have never told me, baby. Well, you know that I wish that I never knew. See, I've got this vision in my mind. In the light awake at night, thinking about it. Hey, yeah. And I don't know what to do. That I could do for you, and I would do anything if you do one thing for me. I said just the one thing for me, please. Show me your tattoo. When I take you out to dinner, a romantic rendezvous, and I buy you champagne and caviar, anything on the menu. Oh, now maybe for dessert, girl, you show me your tattoo, and I get my bucket in my mouth.
And I've seen